I'm going to tell you something that's going to seem crazy. When you go through there, it's 1960. I need you to prevent the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Hello and welcome back to this Big Screen Book Club side series where we're taking a look at the Hulu original series 11/22/63. And on this episode, we'll be talking about episode one. And as always, I am joined by Jeff Ferry.
You're not supposed to be here.
And BJ Kahuna.
Damn it, I didn't prepare.
Oh. That's all right. This isn't like a slight test thing.
Yeah, but I will come prepared next time. I didn't think of it.
And I called you
BJ. I used basically the one memorable line.
Yeah. Is BJ Kahuna a proper...
Yeah.
I was reading the Skype name.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was supposed to be my online alias, but it all fell apart when, you know, especially when Ken just constantly called me by my real name. So
yeah.
And I like when Eric Miller calls me Brian BJ Kahuna Cramp, like, you know, all at once. So that works.
And kind of like, speaking of things falling apart, I think this is a perfect analogy to talk about this first episode. Because I got to say, when I sat down to watch episode one, I was going to start taking notes, and then I just threw my pad up in the air. Jeff, your overall feelings on the series thus far as it relates to the novel?
Like you guys, maybe you guys hated it a little bit more than me. I'm going to admit that it was certainly nothing to write home about. Like, if I had told somebody to watch it and they hadn't read the book, I feel like I'd be getting a stern talking to the next day about, like, why'd you make me watch this? I feel like even though they've got 8 episodes, it looks like they fell into the trap of needing to throw everything at the wall in the first episode.
Yeah.
And, like, I thought they were going to play it slow and slow move into it, and they did the total opposite. It was like they acted like they had an hour and a half to tell a story, and they had to give you every piece of information in that first episode.
Right, right. The thing that was weird about it for me is it seems like they front loaded all of the speculation about whether Oswald did it or not, and it seems like that whole sequence where we have Jake tailing George in that nightclub. It really seemed like they wanted to get that business taken care of first, and I'm not entirely sure why. BJ.
Yeah, well, my big question would be, was this written and filmed as a pilot, or did Hulu order the entire series at once?
Great question.
Because that would be the only way I could rationalize... I couldn't rationalize it, but that would be the only attempt I could make at rationalizing the approach they took here. I mean, it makes no sense at all, but if it was a pilot and they were trying to, you know, get it picked up, then I guess they did it poorly and they did it wrongly, but maybe that's what happened here. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, at this point, I really thought our discussions were going to sort of relate to the differences between the novel and the series, but I think at this point they're kind of off script at this point, but I guess we can try and deduce what is the same and what worked and what really didn't. So I guess the initial setup is there, and I really think they could have spent the first episode getting him to the time portal, if you will. We have we learn that Jake is going through a divorce, and that his friend Al, who owns a diner, introduces him to this time portal concept and the idea that he needs to go back and stop the assassination of John F. Kennedy because Al is no longer well enough to do it. BJ, did you feel that there was enough motivation there for Jake to do it even after Al dies?
I don't know. You know, one thing, I don't know how you guys feel about it, but unfortunately, they seem to have cast the James Franco that hosted the Oscars instead of the James Franco from 127 Hours.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, there's one thing there is not in this episode is character development, especially for this Jake Eppen character. And the way, yeah, they change so much, you know, the way he meets with his, he's meeting with his wife for the divorce, which, you know, in the book, she's an alcoholic or whatever, which who we never even meet. And then Al just comes stumbling in to the diner when it's still open for business after he just came back, you know, and so all of a sudden he has cancer. I mean, they really just, you know, they don't follow the book at all. Like right from the start, they take really basic plot points, but after that, it's just all out the window.
Yeah, it seemed like maybe the intent was to have Al deciding to go back at a moment where Jake is finalizing his divorce and thinking, okay, this might be a moment for me to introduce him to the concept. But then you realize that when Al went through, he didn't even know he had cancer yet.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if – do you guys tell me if I'm right about this? So – Al has this cheap beef that everyone in the town, they don't think it's even real beef because he sells it for so cheap. And the way he sells it for so cheap is because he buys it in 1958. But wouldn't that mean that he has to go save that girl from the hunting accident? I guess I'm in the book now, not the show.
Yeah.
But wouldn't he have to save the girl from the hunting accident every time he goes shopping for beef? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
In the book, I consider that a plot hole.
Because, yeah, it's a huge hole, right?
but I think listening to Stephen King's writing, he has admitted that he's left plot holes in before, even after he discovered them, because it still gets his point across. And yeah. This is a good point you brought up about the girl that gets shot, because that's not introduced at all in this.
Yeah, that's something they completely took out, yeah.
So the only time he goes back and there's any way he knows what happens is when he carves his name in the tree, which is what Al does in the book. So the whole point in the book is he tells him the story about the girl. I go back to save him. He tells the whole story about how that's when he first learns time's obdurate. It tries to stop you. The girl gets shot. She gets paralyzed. Then he goes back and saves her. And then he tells Jake, and then he shows him the newspaper with the girl in the wheelchair. And he says, well, how do you have this newspaper of the girl in the wheelchair if you saved her? And he's like, you went back. It all reset. Mm-hmm. So that brought it home to Jake. Like, it was real. Like, that girl is now in a wheelchair because you went in there.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, he understands real-world consequences, where there's none of that in this. He just – and they also remove the part, which is one of the more fun parts of the book, when he – the first time he goes back, when he just goes – he goes to, like, the malt shop. He gets, like, something, and he's just talking to the guy. You never get to find out how fun the 50s or, I guess, 1960 is.
Yeah.
It's just the minute he walks back, he has the weird thing with the yellow card man, and then he immediately runs back in. And you're like, what the hell? What was that?
Yeah, no, I would agree. I would say that I'm very curious to see where they go with the treatment of the yellow card man, and I guess he's there because he's going to be needed for the wrap up of the series. But for Al not to even introduce any of the rules to Jake on how to interact with him just seemed weird to me. And the other thing that seemed weird to me was how long had Jake been talking with Al about what to do once he got there, because Al dies, Jake goes through, and then he's got all these flashbacks of Al telling him, you know, what to do. It just seemed to me like, how many hours worth of conversations did he have with Al? And then why would he have such cold feet about doing this after having such specific conversations with Al? Jeff?
Yeah, it was a strange setup how they did it. Like, I thought they were going to use flashbacks, because in the book, and in most books, you can front load people in books. You can't do that in TV. You can't have 25 minutes of him talking to Al. So I understand why you had flashbacks. Plus, that allows you, maybe in episode 2 and 3, you still can have Chris Cooper drop in, who honestly probably is your best actor.
Yes.
I mean, just because he's the only one that looked like he had a pulse in the show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Everybody else was like, I know you were talking about James Franco. I can't even blame him. If I had to put the blame on somebody, my blame's on the director. Like, his main job is to stand there and look perplexed. The only time he had any acting chops at all is when he gets caught by, I guess, the Secret Service or the FBI. And he kind of has to weasel his way out of it. But at that point, that's an hour plus into it. And I'm still – my head's still spinning, because in the book, I'm rereading it right now, about halfway through it. They're just now starting to talk about George to whatever his name is.
Yeah.
That's 400 pages in.
Yeah. Well, the other thing to me, too, is in the series, at least, in that first episode, when things start to go terribly wrong for Jake, when he gets has that interaction with the Secret Service, and then he goes back to the house that or the room that he's rented, and it's been burned down. At that point, instead of going to Kentucky to save Henry or George? I don't remember.
It's Harry.
Harry. Why doesn't he just go back through the portal and start over?
I thought the same thing. Because he hasn't done anything yet. There's no reason not to reset.
And I'm sure it's been a couple of days at that point, right? It's not like he's invested months.
Yeah, and it looks like – I don't know how you guys look at this. If you remember in the book, he goes through – he stays this, I guess it's about 6 weeks, and saves Harry's family except for the one kid.
Yeah.
And then he goes back out and restarts the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they don't seem to be showing any indication of doing that. It looks like he's in it now. He's in it for the long haul.
Yeah, which seems really strange to me because it really makes Jake seem, I don't know if not intelligent is the right word, but not intelligent. Oh, really?
It made him look like an idiot when he did that bet.
Well, yeah, and that's another thing that they sort of front-loaded, too. It was like, you know, Al sends him back with just enough money to buy a car.
Yeah, and that's a point in the book is that he's not wealthy, but I think Al gives him $6,000.
Yeah.
Which is plenty of money because the car is only like $300. And he keeps saying, I don't have a lot of money, but, you know, as long as I make the occasional bet here and there. In the book, he makes a bunch of little bets, and then one time he gets a little too greedy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when it all turns on him. In this one, he just does something that if you did it today, if you walked in and made an impossible bet that hit, you're not walking out of there. He could have just went in and bet the fight and got 2-1 and walked out with twice his money.
Yeah.
Yeah, that made him look like an idiot. It makes you dislike the character, which is the total opposite of what the book is like.
Yeah. BJ, any thoughts surrounding the idea that Jake is sort of all in at this moment?
Well, I mean, they've moved the location. I guess – well, does it start in the show? Does it start in Maine? Are they in Maine?
He's in Lisbon Falls, Maine.
Right. And so they've moved the location of this family to Kentucky, I guess, to just – so that it's on his way back from Texas, I guess.
And I mean, this would be a minor issue. If this was the only issue, I would have never mentioned it. But as a Stephen King fan, I'm terribly, terribly disappointed it wasn't in Derry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because those are all the It connections, right?
Yeah, the It connections. I don't know if you caught in the book. The other connections I caught in the book are he keeps talking about every time he goes back, he walks over and he puts his hand on the back of the Plymouth Fury. And that's the same kind of car Christine is.
Yeah.
Oh.
So, and I think it may be the same year. So it may actually be Christine that he walks by. And there's I can't remember what it is. I'm a bad Stephen King fan. There was one other like random mention of one of his other things. I'm sure I'll remember it next week.
Well, like, that's one of the criticism that I've seen online from people is the disappointment that that Derry is not in the series.
Well, that was a big factor in the book. He makes a big deal about how he gets to Derry and immediately everything is wrong. He hates the town. The town is evil. The town itself is against him. And then he compares it when he gets to Dallas. He says Dallas is the same way. It's got like that shroud of evil over it.
Mm-hmm.
Like just everything. He won't live there because it's so bad.
Yeah.
Which I agree. Dallas is terrible.
Yes.
Now, BJ, looking ahead to, I guess, tomorrow when episode 2 drops, do you think at this point I don't want to say that the series is lost, but do you think they can salvage the show based on the setup thus far?
I guess maybe, especially if this was done as a pilot and that's why it was put together this way. Maybe they're going to take their time a little more with, are there 7 more?
Yeah.
I mean, there's still a lot of really cool things that they can do on this show and there's a lot of really great ideas, you know, to work with. So I guess there's hope for it, but yeah, I mean, they really, really dropped the ball in this first episode. And Jeff was talking about the director. That's Kevin MacDonald, who, do you guys listen to WTF, the Mark Maron?
Yeah, podcast? Yeah. He was on the episode where Mark thought he was getting Kevin MacDonald from the Kids in the Hall.
Yeah, Mark thought he was getting the guy from Kids in the Hall, and this guy knocked on his door, and then Mark just pretended that he planned on interviewing that guy, but then he ended up putting them both on the same episode. Yeah, so that's the guy that directed this.
Yeah, and he also directed, like, The Last King of Scotland. I mean, he's a...
Right, right.
You know, he's by no means a director that's not capable.
Obviously, a lot of thought went into how they approached this first episode. I think they just made a lot of poor choices, but obviously they had something in mind when they decided to do this with this episode. It wasn't an accident, that's for sure. So,
but I mean, you have seven episodes. Like, at this point now, they're already up to, he's basically heading to where Harry is. You now have seven episodes for the, if you're not doing the girl that gets shot, now you've only got the Harry thing, Sadie, and all the JFK stuff. They really, I mean, if you could put this first episode behind you, they really have time to develop all that. I'll tell you exactly how they turn it around. Make that whole Harry situation as compelling as it is in the book. Because that stuff is nail-biting in the book. When
going
after the family.
Well, and
Go ahead, go ahead.
Well, I was wondering, since they already showed Sadie, he already just ran into her in Dealey Plaza or whatever, are they even going to handle him meeting Sadie and all of that the same way? Because, you know, that seems to be an indication that maybe not. Maybe they're going to approach all of that in a completely different way. I don't know.
I mean, I guess they could still have the same little meet cute that they have, except this time it'll be like, hey, I remember you.
I mean, I remember you as that random person.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, I understand some of it. I understand that they put her in that episode because, God forbid, you don't see the love interest in the first episode.
Yeah, well, I guess at this point, let's talk about maybe the things that we did like. and
I thought we did that.
Well, I got to say, though, there were a couple things that I was pleasantly surprised with. The overall running time of the episode, and I'm not sure if moving forward, you know, if this was a pilot, they were going for more than 90-minute setup, and then all the episodes are going to fall into that hour mark. But the idea that these episodes could be longer than a standard hour was really good to see, and it made me a little bit more hopeful that they'll have a little bit more room to breathe. And Jeff, that sort of speaks to your, you know, your suggestion that hopefully they really get the most out of the Dunning family situation. But I also really like the production design on the show. I mean, it doesn't look like there was any expense spared to recreate 1960. If I had any complaint, it looked a little too busy for me. But that, I think that might have also helped sort of slap Jake in the face, if you will, to the reality that he was in 1960. Things that you like, Jeff.
I'm thinking. But yeah, production design was good. I actually didn't mind. I wouldn't have minded the owl stuff as much. Like, I understand why they were doing flashbacks and this and that. I mean, I did like Chris Cooper, but again, I feel like they just cut it up all wrong, and there were some weird time things about, like, you didn't quite know what was going on. He seemed to die very quickly.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm trying to think. Like, the problem is there's no place where I could point and be like, well, that was horrible. That's the worst thing I've ever seen. Most of it was just how they put – like, it really seemed like they tried to jam so much in there. Mm-hmm. It's not quite like under the dome, they just did everything differently, where this, it just seems like we're just going to throw a ton of stuff in there and we'll set it up for the series. Now that BJ has brought it up, it does really smell like a pilot.
Yeah. No.
We've got to show everybody every character. We got to show them the Dunnings. We got to show them Sadie. We got to – for some reason, he runs into JFK in the first episode.
Yeah.
Okay, like you do. JFK to boot.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
No, I feel that's what they were going for. And it's one of those 8-series episode. I'm very willing to give the first one a mulligan, especially since I know what's coming up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. BJ, things that you sort of took away from the first episode that made you feel pretty good.
Yeah, I don't know if I have anything for that. I could tell you There was one part that made me laugh, but it wasn't on purpose, I guess. But I was watching it with the closed captioning on. Did you guys watch it with the closed captioning on, maybe?
No, I should have.
I don't think so.
Do you remember this scene where he's in class, and I guess he's playing them a film, and the kid in the back is laughing at his phone? Yeah. It ends up being that parrot video that he uses then later.
Yeah.
So he turns around, and I don't remember the kid's name, but he just says, you know, Josh, or whatever, and he looks at the kid. But on the closed captioning, it said, Josh, what the fuck? And I was like, why was that there? This is a teacher talking to a student, and he doesn't say that in the show, but it was in the closed captioning. Yeah, that was probably my favorite part of the whole episode.
That is funny. I wonder if they were using the captioning, they were just using the script as a guide.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. No, I did not like really anything about... Yeah, I do agree. It looks good. It does look good, but... Yeah, I mean, I don't know. There wasn't much to like about it for me, this first episode, at least.
Mm-hmm. So that really brings us to, I think, the end of our discussion for episode one. I mean, at this point, I'm not sure. I think moving forward, we're going to be able to point out instances where the series and the book line up. But for the most part, it seems like we're on a path now where things are going to be, you know, pretty different, or it's going to be pretty scattershot where they borrow things from the novel. So it will be interesting to see as we move along with each episode how this series plays out. Jeff, do you have any final thoughts?
I'm just hoping the next episode will be better.
And BJ?
Yeah, same here. Same here. You know, reading the book, I kept thinking about, you know, since in the book he goes back to, he's in 1958 and then he's got 5 years to kill, right? Which is a long time to kill. And I was thinking, what did you have tried to come up with other things maybe you could change in that time? I mean, I know you have to deal with the obdurate past, but, you know, I was just thinking, you know, February 3rd, 1959, just head on over to Clear Lake, Iowa and stop Buddy Holly from getting on that airplane. You know, I mean, he's got nothing to do anyways.
And in the show, there's no reason why he can't do that. In the book, it's made quite clear that Al is losing the diner. Mm-hmm. So he's like, you maybe got a week, so you don't have time. I mean, he doesn't have time to think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he ends up rushing in there real quick and not thinking. Because remember, when he gets there, he says, if I would have thought about it, I would have looked up stocks instead of gambling. Because that's way safer. Why fool around with gambling if you could just bet stocks or if you could just play stocks?
Right.
Well, and I was also thinking once Al gets cancer, then he could say, you know, hey, go find me when I'm 10 years old or whatever and make sure I don't start smoking. You know, but and I also looked up Mark David Chapman was born in 1955 and he was living in Fort Worth, you know, so.
Yeah,
you know,
take him out.
Just hit that fucker with your car and then head on over to Dallas.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I was thinking.
See, that's the problem. I would have gone too far the other way. I would have grabbed the book. I'd be driving around the town. I would end up being jailed for killing 50 people because I'm going around killing all these monsters that are born during this time frame.
Yeah, exactly. Richard Ramirez was born in 1960 in El Paso. So, you know, and that gave me the idea of a movie about a serial killer, but it turns out he's a guy from the future who's going back in time and killing a bunch of people.
That's great, you know,
like an ironic version of a serial killer.
I would like it's to sort see of, you I your guess, trial like trying to explain. No, all these babies that I killed, they were all going to grow up to be serial killers.
Yeah, little Ted Bundy.
Yeah. Oh, what an interesting concept for a story springing out of Stephen King's book. Yeah. So, we will get together again next week for episode two, and hopefully we have, or I'm sure we're going to have plenty to talk about. And Jeff, before we go, just want to say that your book, The Dawn of Mars, is available in physical format as well as the ebook format, correct?
Yes, indeed, and audio if you're a fan of that type of thing.
Excellent.
Don't be alarmed. I don't read it.
And BJ, your wonderful rock and or roll podcast is available for people to listen to as well.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, I got to say, I've been enjoying the last couple of episodes. The interview you did with Dickerling. Yeah, The guy that wrote the book.
James Dickerson.
Yeah, James Dickerson, about Colonel Tom, right?
Yeah,
Colonel Tom Parker, Elvis's manager, was a really great listen. And the Chips Enough episode interview, that was so great. I can't imagine there was a time where he sat down and talked his career longer than he did with you. Maybe on the Stern Show years ago, but he didn't have as much to talk about then.
Yeah, that was the perfect kind of interview because he just talked and I didn't have to do a whole lot, you know?
Yeah. And you also recently put an episode up where you play a bunch of songs that are under 2 minutes long.
Yeah, 50 songs that are all less than 2 minutes long.
Yeah.
So, and this is the second time I've done that. So,
yeah. So if you're a fan of music or rock and or roll or really long form interviews, BJ's really got it all over at the Rock and or Roll podcast. So please make sure you check it out. And I'll include links to both of those, the show and Jeff's book, in our show notes. So guys, once again, thank you. And we'll see you next week.
Cool. Thanks.